This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Adrienne Hill. There are two places most of us spend our time, at home and at work. Now, we're done talking about homes for this week, and we're going to spend the rest of the show talking about the office, which can be filled, at least in my experience, with all sorts of craziness and crazy people. I'm not going to name any names. Our conversation about this topic started online. We had people write into Facebook and on Twitter, and we got a bunch of emails from people looking for advice about how to deal with their workplace dilemmas, their bosses, their colleagues. Well, help is at hand in the form of Ben Dattner. He's an organizational psychologist and the author of The Blame Game. Hi, Ben.
Good to be with you.
So I want to start right in here. What are the common mistakes that we all make when we're trying to get ahead at work? And how do we actually derail ourselves?
Well, I'm an adjunct coach at the Center for Creative Leadership, which means I coach executives about how to maximize their success in their careers, how to have positive impact on the organizations they work in and they lead. And what the Center for Creative Leadership has found over decades of longitudinal research is that people who don't focus on workplace relationships, on organizational politics, and on team dynamics are people who are likely to derail no matter how smart they are technically, financially, or operationally.
So I've got to get along. To get ahead, I've got to get along with people.
That's correct.
All right. I want to go straight to our callers here. And we have Jennifer from Baltimore who has a story, as I understand it, about a former boss. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
So tell us your story about your former boss.
In a previous career, I had a boss who would call me into her office and privately tell me that she saw a lot of herself in me from 10 years before, that she really thought the world of me, all these wonderful things. And then anytime there was a meeting or any sort of public gathering where I had to present something, she would, in some way, shape, or form, dismiss me, humiliate me, or scold me.
Ugh.
So it was rather confusing.
Really confusing.
Yeah.
What do you do, Ben, if you've got a boss who's hot sometimes and cold others?
Well, the first thing to do is to try to answer the question, why? Why is she doing this? Why is she shaming me, undercutting me, and humiliating me? So that can be a tough question to answer. I think people often make the mistake of too quickly going to the boss's personality and try to understand what is it about the boss's personality that is causing her to do this.
Right.
And it may well be the boss's personality. She might be on the spectrum of some kind of personality disorder or difficulty. But before you diagnose that, it's important to try to figure out what is it also about the situation that might be encouraging her to act that way.
And what did you think? Do you have a sense of why she was doing it?
Well, the closest I could come is that I was kind of relatively new in this field, but I was kind of really doing quite well, and I thought I might be threatening her in some way, shape, or form. She was new in her position as well. But it was certainly uncomfortable, regardless of why, and I didn't quite know how to respond to kind of move beyond it, and I ended up leaving the field, leaving the job and leaving the field.
Mm-hmm.
When is that the right thing to do, just to say it's not working?
Well, what I say in my book, The Blame Game, I talk about this, which is that it's not always possible to make a workplace situation better, but it's always possible to make it worse. So if you act, if you overreact, if you're too emotional, if you respond too quickly, you can sometimes make things worse. Now, in the situation that our caller is describing, it may not be possible to make it better. There may be political reasons why your boss is doing this. There may be psychological reasons why your boss is doing this. And even if you confront her, it may be the case that she's not going to stop doing this. However, I think people sometimes prematurely make that judgment, and quitting can be a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Now, Jennifer, did you ever say to your boss, what's going on?
There were a few occasions where I said, well, you know, we had talked about this issue before we had this meeting, and I brought it up at this meeting, and you seemed so supportive privately, and publicly it did not go well. She said, well, you know, it was just, you know, the organization's not quite ready for it yet, and, I could not figure out why. And she never really kind of made anything really clear to me about what was really behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So I, in my confusion, just said, forget it. I'm going to law school.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Jennifer.
Thank you.
So we've got another call. We actually have a couple of questions here about generational differences at work, where you've got a younger boss or you've got older colleagues, older coworkers, sort of the ways that different generations interact with each other. And the first caller we've got is William from North Olmsted, Ohio. Hi, William.
Hello.
So what's going on? What kind of, tell me about your work.
Well, right now I'm a paramedic here in Cleveland area, and quite often prior to this, I just became paramedic 4 months ago. Prior to that, I would regularly be paired up with another paramedic as I would be a basic, and my paramedic partner would be 21, 22, and I'm pushing 45.
Okay, so significantly younger.
Significantly younger, yes. It was a lot like being in the military again, where you're, you know, much older, and the person who's in charge of you is fresh out of college.
So does that make you a para-paramedics?
sometimes there's para. There's two of us. But yes.
So what's your question for Ben, William?
Well, just generally, it's how do you, what's the best strategy for dealing with people who are younger than you, don't have the experience that you do, but are in charge of you? When you tell them, hey, you know, that's a great idea, but we did that back in 99.
And it didn't work then.
Yeah. Or here's what's wrong with why it didn't work then.
Well, one organization that I think has had to deal with this issue in particular is the military, because you have young lieutenants coming out of West Point and they're leading military teams that have sergeants or corporals who have many, many years in the military, 20, 25 years of experience, and they have combat experience, et cetera. And I think what you need to do, first of all, being mindful that it is a challenge, I think, is the first step. I think if you're not understanding that that provides a constraint to your leadership, if you don't know it, there's no way you're going to be able to handle it. But I think trying to explicitly convey respect, I respect your experience, I respect your perspective, I'm not going to pull rank on you. However, I do have the position of authority here, and so I need you in turn to respect that. I think in my experience doing executive coaching, one mistake people often make who are younger, who have older people working for them, is they tell and they don't show. Mm-hmm. So they tell people, here's my authority, here's my expertise, here's my plan, and they may be protesting too much, working too hard to prove their knowledge rather than focusing on getting the task done.
Now, if you're an older – if you're in a situation where you're the older person and the person who's calling the shots is younger, how do you convey, hey, I do have some institutional knowledge that might be useful in a way that they don't feel like you're trying to step on – you don't step on their toes?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think directly and indirectly conveying respect for their rank and prefacing anything you say, which is, you know, I thought it might be helpful for me to share my perspective or my experience, and err on the side of being very clear that you're not trying to undercut them, you're not trying to criticize them, you're not concerned about their capabilities or their abilities, but you're simply trying to lend a perspective.
And William, have you had that come up for you? Have there been moments where you've tried that?
Many times. I was a first sergeant in the Army for a while, so I got to deal with that 24-year-old, 26-year-old captain, you know, and tell him, no, ma'am, it doesn't work that way, but had to do it in a polite way. And a lot of times it was doing exactly as he described.
Well, one question that academic researchers have been grappling with is there's sort of a debate about, do generational differences really make a difference or not? Is it that you're dealing with millennials now and the young colleague that you described would be presumably born after 1985, so a member of the millennial generation? So does your colleague have particular attributes that are specific to being a millennial, or is it the kind of attributes that anyone at that age, whether they were a Generation X, Generation Y, Baby Boomer, Greatest Generation, that's something that's intrinsic to 20-year-olds rather than something that's intrinsic to millennials?
And what does the research tell us? Where are researchers on this right now?
Well, it's hard to say because, first of all, it's a new area because people have only been millennials for only a few years, so it's hard to establish any kind of longitudinal data. But I think the consensus is that there are some aspects that are specific to this generation having to do with technology, having to do with tweeting, blogging, social media, mm-hmm. Being linked into screens all the time, that difference in the way that people live, work, and communicate has led to some differences in the way people act and react in general and in the workplace in particular. But there's also some evidence that there's just something about being a 20-year-old that makes you act and react in certain ways as well.
William, thanks so much for your call. And Ben, I'm going to have you stay with us. We've got more calls coming up. This is Marketplace Money from APM. Today, we're talking workplace dynamics, and we've got workplace psychologist Ben Dattner with us answering listener questions. Ben, we have another caller here. We have Julian from New York. Hi, Julian.
Hello.
How's New York this time of year?
Very rainy, but It's a good day to be working.
But spring has sprung?
It has sprung, thankfully.
So you've got a question for Ben. What's going on?
Yes, Ben, I really appreciate some help. I lead a human resources team. We've got about 15 people, and initially the team had gotten along quite well, but recently we've been under a lot of pressure for deliverables and running some major processes for our clients around pay planning and the like, and there have been some errors and some slippages in terms of things committed to clients, and the atmosphere in the team has really devolved into a lot of conflict, a lot of finger-pointing. Individual team members come to me to complain about each other. I encourage them to go talk with each other, not about each other. I tried to address it in a team meeting, but there was really not much energy and a lot of silence around trying to address things. It doesn't seem to be working, and the level of teamwork has really disintegrated, and it's not really fun to come to work right now for some of the team members, and it just consumes a lot of my time trying to coach people and have these therapeutic conversations with them. I'm hoping you might be able to give me some guidance on some new things I could try.
Great. Well, are roles and responsibilities clearly specified? Because sometimes what happens is that people look at personality conflicts and think, okay, these personality conflicts are the cause of the difficulty our team is having in communicating and collaborating. But sometimes those personality, on the surface, personality conflicts are really an effect of misaligned incentives or processes, structures, or incentives on the team.
I guess generally the roles and responsibilities are fairly clear in terms of who does what, but maybe with regard to some of the things we've been asked to implement recently, maybe that is a potential issue that we need to at least clarify, you know, who gets to make what decision and who's accountable to who.
So has anything worked? Has anything started to work? Any sort of hints that things might turn around?
Not as yet. You know, I think there are people who take individual initiative and do heroic things and work very hard to fix problems and stay late into the night. But it's not necessarily because of good process or because we're working well together collectively.
Do you hold the team collectively accountable for results?
I guess there are some things I could possibly do in terms of communicating that I am holding them collectively accountable for results. I guess I assume that's implicit, and there may be some things I could do to communicate that more explicitly and give them the sense we're all in this together, mm-hmm. and we rise or fall together.
What I find can be helpful is when you let individuals and the teams know, here's what constitutes doing your work, and here's what constitutes doing it well. Here's the what of what you're individually and collectively accountable for, and also we're going to be paying attention to the how. So it sounds like you guys are having challenges with the how as well as the what.
You know, it's funny. We sometimes give our clients better service than we give ourselves. You know, we give them the best of us. And, you know, we do some of that work with our clients when we are setting goals with them and helping them with their performance management process. We get them focused on not only what are the goals, but what are the key behaviors that they need to demonstrate in order to achieve those goals. And that really helps kind of define the culture for goal accomplishment. We haven't done that for ourselves, especially around these recent processes that we've been having some struggles implementing.
Well, I have a blog for Psychology Today, and I wrote a blog post a while back called The Cobbler's Children Syndrome. And it's actually quite common that people and teams have the toughest time doing for themselves what they're most adept and talented and charged at doing for the people they service or serve.
So at a big level, Ben, what do you think when you're in a workplace that's just not healthy, where people are pointing fingers, they're grumpy, they hate being there? What's the first thing to do? How do you start to change some that?
Well, as a colleague of mine likes to say, treatment without diagnosis is malpractice. So the first thing that you like to do, need to do, is to try to figure out what are the underlying causes? What are the causes? What are the effects of the difficulties that we're having? And what variables can we tweak in order to try to make things better?
Julian, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben, for the help.
Thanks.
So I want to go to another caller, Jay in Raleigh. Are you with us now?
Yes, I am. How y'all doing?
Good. Thanks so much for calling, Jay. So tell me a little, what do you do for a living?
I'm a support engineer for one of the world's largest communications equipment manufacturers.
And what's your question for Ben?
So the current trend in offices is to go to a more open floor plan, you know, less offices with four walls and a door. And so, you know, in cubicle land, you have certain, I guess, etiquette that should be followed. For example, you know, in open spaces, you have the problem of noise. Some people have voices that carry, not really their fault, but, you know, you have people with bad habits. They like to take phone calls on speakerphone wide with it turned all the way up, or, you know, yell across the cubes. I guess what's a good way within an organization to sort of encourage better etiquette in these more common open spaces without, you know, making people feel singled out?
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, this is a little personal to me. I actually had somebody tape a note on my phone once that said, "Quiet down." Maybe that's not the best way to deal with it, Ben. What do you think?
That is some pretty direct and candid feedback.
And I did quiet down, so it did work. But what do you think? How do you deal with a loud talker?
Okay, well, as a general rule, I think individuals, teams, and organizations should have built-in self-reflection, process checks, and mechanisms for feedback. So I think it's tough when you have to go up to a coworker and say, "Look, can you please be quiet?" I think it's much easier to say, "We're going to an open office plan. Why don't we have regular check-ins where we all come together and talk about how it's going?" So rather than singling out your coworker and making him or her feel defensive, you can just say in a very gentle way, "It's been great that we all have easier access to one another and can see each other at all times. On the other hand, sometimes there's a bit of noise and it's a bit distracting." So if you can say that in a kind of gentle, indirect way about the entire organization or the entire office, that could be less confrontational than singling someone out.
But what if your boss doesn't call that meeting? I mean, what if you never have an opportunity to have that conversation? What do you do?
You can gently suggest to the boss, "Hey, you know, physical space is very important when it comes to interactions in the workplace. Maybe we need to reconvene and just think, how is this going? There are obviously pros and cons." And without arguing that we need to revisit it, because for cost reasons and logistical reasons and architectural reasons, it might not be possible to revisit it. But why don't we have check-ins and see how is it actually going, whether there's any major change, if we go to a hoteling system of offices, if we change the nature of our authority, our roles, our interactions. It's always good to build in process checks.
What do you think, Jay? Do you think they'd be open to that kind of meeting at your workplace?
I would think so, yeah, absolutely.
Are you going to go ask for it?
Yeah, I'll go ask
or
about it.
Or scream for it? You could just yell.
Alternatively, you can just give us the initials of the offenders in your office and send them the link to this segment.
You could do that.
Maybe also a little more passive-aggressive than you want to be. Jay, thank you so much for your phone call.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Ben, we've got a few more questions coming up, but we're going to take a quick break. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Adrienne Hill. On today's show, we're talking about the workplace, how to survive, how to thrive at work. We've got all sorts of callers. We've got lots of Facebook questions, and we've got Ben Dattner here to help us answer all of them. He's an organizational psychologist and workplace consultant. Hi, Ben.
Always a pleasure.
So, Ben, the next question I have for you actually comes from our Facebook account from a listener named Angela. And she writes, "After being laid off, I had to take a low-paying job as an assistant that I'm overqualified for. I'm not sure people will believe in me when I try to move up." So you've taken a job. Lots of people have done this in this economy, a job that's well under their skill set. How do you get ahead? How do you get somebody to take you seriously, sort of maybe at the job you're actually meant to be in?
Well, what I always advise my coaching clients to do is to focus on their ings, as I call them.
Their ings.
Their ings, their gerunds, which is, what are the ings where you're most passionate, engaged, and successful in what you're doing? Do you like reading, writing, presenting, arguing, advocating, healing, etc.? Finding your ings is more important than the particular role that you're in at any given moment. So people's success in their careers is powered by their ings. So you can be in a high-level job with the wrong ings or a low-level job with the right ings.
So if I really like talking, I should find a job somewhere talking, even if it's a low-level job talking.
That's right, because you're likely to be more engaged, more passionate, more motivated, and more successful if you're in your zone of flow.
Now, how do you advise somebody like Angela? Let's say she is in a job that meets her it's actually meeting that ing for her, whatever it is. But she's at a very low level, and she just doesn't think her colleagues are going to take her seriously when she applies for the job the next level up, even if she does have those qualifications.
Well, successful individuals work in the situation that they're in. They work hard, they're focused, they add value, they build strong relationships. And as a result, when the need arises within the organization, there can be opportunities to move up. So it's like starting with a blank slate. Rather than focusing on, I used to be at one level and now I'm at a lower level, mm-hmm. think about it instead. This is the cards I'm dealing right now. I've been dealt right now. This is what I'm dealing with. How can I make the best out of this?
So you don't just come up and say, hey, look at my resume. I'm actually really qualified for this job. No?
Well, as we were discussing earlier, showing is always a better strategy than telling.
Huh.
Showing people your capability rather than telling them, I used to be a star. I used to be a contender.
Right.
Nobody's going to care. It's more about showing what you can do in the moment in the particular role that you're in. And it's important also to manage your own emotions, to not feel defensive or embarrassed about the situation that you're in. Any situation has opportunities, and any situation has challenges. Every hand's a winner. Every hand's a loser.
Angela, thanks so much for writing into our Facebook page. Ben, we've got one more caller, Kathleen from Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So tell us a little about your situation. Where are you working? What kind of job do you have right now?
I'm a PhD student, and I work in a research lab. And we have a very diverse set of people who work in this particular lab. We have some students who are older, and I would say mid to late 30s, some even early 40s, or we have very, very younger students who are in their early 20s and don't necessarily have professional experience. So what we find out is, even though it's a research lab, we still have a business setting. We still have to, you know, present to various stakeholders. And our issue that we run into constantly is that the younger students really don't understand the tribal rituals of business. You know, what is etiquette? What are the formalities of, you know, handshaking, how to conduct yourself during a business meeting, sometimes even how to speak. And then we have an additional factor to that is that we have a very culturally diverse population as well. So we also have foreign students. And sometimes, let's just say that the clothing isn't always professional. And it's how do you know how to approach someone on not only just an etiquette level, but maybe a professional clothing level when you have this cultural diversity, because you don't want to offend anybody culturally.
When you say inappropriate, can you help me understand what you're talking about?
We will have younger students who really come in, particularly sometimes female, who are dressing almost like young teenagers, very, very young teenagers, and it can be very provocative.
And just to be clear, you're not the boss, is that right? You're just a colleague.
Exactly. But, you know, it reflects on all of us, is that in that kind of environment, it does reflect on all of us because we all have to be involved and we're all kind of the same stature. So when something goes bad, you know, it is a reflection of the entire group.
How do you handle that? So you're in a big workplace environment, Ben. You maybe don't have the institutional support. Can Kathleen make some helpful suggestions?
Well, she could suggest that there be a workshop, or she could find some materials or some videos on the internet about common mistakes that people make in terms of attire, grooming, style, and interviews, and try to share those best practices. Looking at the programmatic level, what is our success rate? What kind of feedback do we get, whether it's formal or informal?
So in general, should I not, if I have a colleague who's doing something that maybe I'm uncomfortable with or I don't feel like reflects well on the organization, should I not approach that person directly?
Always better to try to approach them indirectly in
right.
a way that, particularly if people are from different cultures, doesn't cause them to lose face, to be humiliated and embarrassed. So the more you can say, hey, we all stand to improve on this particular dimension, rather than I'm singling out you, one particular colleague, for some candid feedback.
Kathleen, thanks so much for giving us a call.
Thank you.
Ben, we just have a minute here, but before I let you go, I want to ask you one question that's probably on the minds of a lot of people, or at least on our minds for the last 4 years, which is, how do you make sure you're not the first person that gets cut at the end of the day?
I think it's important to realize that we have multiple jobs and to not just think that your job, being successful in your job, is doing the tasks you've been assigned successfully. It's also about making your boss look good to other people, making your colleagues look good, making your boss feel good, making your colleagues feel good. So it's not just about the what, it's also about the how. As Maya Angelou says, People forget what you said, they forget what you did, but what they never forget is how you made them feel. So we all have to realize that there is a socio-emotional component to our careers and our workplace success.
So be nice. Bottom line, be nice.
Do not do unto others what would be hateful to be done unto you.
Ben Dattner is an organizational psychologist and author of The Blame Game, How the Hidden Rules of Credit and Blame Determine Our Success or Failure. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thank you.